Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. One of my favorite interviews in recent years was our conversation with James Zimring about his book, What Science Is and How It Really Works. So when we found out that Jim was coming out with a new book about how humans can be fooled by the numbers involved in everything from advertising to scientific studies and the state of the economy, I couldn't wait to read it. His new book is called Partial Truths, and the way the title is printed on the cover is an indication of the thesis for Zimring's work. The word partial with a slash sign over truths, with the denominator in all caps. It's a fraction. And while many of us may have struggled with fractions in school, they really are a window into how the world works. And Professor Zimring is the perfect person to guide us into understanding how easily we can be manipulated by people who count on our not understanding them. James Zimring is the Thomas W. Tillack Professor of Experimental Pathology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He joins us now to talk about his new book, Partial Truths. Jim Zimring, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, well, let's start out with your previous book, which I dearly love, What is Science and How Does It Really Work, which is a great book. What led you to write this book from there? How did you get from there to here? What was the impetus for this?
Yeah, well, this book kind of grew out of the writing of the previous book, only because when you start to, anyone studies things, trends emerge. And I noticed a common form that a lot of human errors and scientific methods rely upon, which is can be described in the form of a fraction. And so a lot of our errors and misperceptions and also correct cognitive processes can be described by this general form. And so I thought, this is a theme that tends to run through a lot of things. I can use it as an instrument to kind of explore that. And importantly for this book, what the manifestations of that are in the real world, which a lot of cognitive psychology books don't really explore so much.
Yeah. And well, look, fractions are one of those subjects too that in school, why is it that fractions are so challenging, do you think?
Math is a language. It's just a language to describe nature, but it's a language with particular properties and symbols that are unfamiliar, and it's abstract. But fractions are a common notion, right? Even in English, we'll say half of the time or a one in a million chance. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I'm not saying, by the way, that this is not, first of all, this is not a math book.
No, it's not.
Yeah. And some people who have read it seem very relieved that that's the case. And I'm not saying that our brains are calculators that have fractions inside them. And that, I'm not saying that either. I'm just saying we can use the fractions as a lens to try to understand these things. But really all a fraction is it's saying of a group of things, how many of those things have a particular property? And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. Well, there's a really famous example of folks getting a fraction wrong, and that deals with hamburgers. There's the famous story, I think it's kind of famous now, of when, the famous quarter pounder. And then another burger chain decided, well, we'll make a bigger burger. We'll make a third of a pound. And yet, Jim, what happened?
Yeah, not only was it a bigger burger, but it tasted better in blind taste tests, and it was cheaper, and it failed miserably. And after the fact, when they did kind of a market analysis to see what had happened, they realized that the majority of people thought that a third pound was less than a quarter pound, because 3 is less than 4.
Yeah, that just always astounds me, but I can also understand it. That's kind of somehow how our minds work. And that's one of the really interesting things in this book, is you do constantly refer to our brains evolved, to do certain things. We were hunter-gatherers. And, we would hear stories about, like, over the hill, there's a pride of lions, don't go over there. Things like that. And how that, that embedded thinking sometimes gets in our way in our modern data-driven society. Is that a fair assessment of one of the themes in your book?
Completely. So we love anecdotal evidence. It resonates with us. We're storytelling creatures. But that is seldom what's you know, a good picture compared to population-based data, statistical data, and even trained professionals favor anecdotal data over, you know, larger population-based data. So yeah, I think that this is fundamentally problematic. Now, let me take a step back and say, it makes me sad when I hear people say, well, you know, anecdotal evidence is not data, or the plural of anecdote is not data. That's not true. Anecdotal data is a very important vanguard of our observations. I mean, we only noticed the AIDS epidemic because of anecdotal reports mm-hmm. out of California, but it can't stop there because anecdotal evidence is very misleading. And that's why there are specific scientific and statistical methodologies to go further and then ask the question, is that misleading us, or is that showing us something new that is real?
Well, sure. And, you know, as human beings, we tend to trust people that we know. So, you know, if somebody that you know that also knows you, you know, tells you, oh, I think you would really like this, whether it be a restaurant or a vacation destination or a movie or whatever, if they know you and they're your friend and they tell you, I saw this, I did this, I tasted that, you tend to trust that.
Completely true. And by the way, oftentimes it is correct, right? So when you tell someone smoking increases your risk of dying from cancer, and they say, well, I knew this guy, Bob, who smoked every day of his life, and he lived to 102 and never got cancer. Well, both of those statements are true, right? It's just that we tend to reject the first based on the second, even though the anecdote is just a single data point and the first statement is a statement. So anecdotal information can be factually correct, but completely misrepresent what's actually going on.
In your book, you give so many like wonderful examples of how our minds work compared to, you know, what the solution to a problem is. One of my favorite stories is the True Scotsman story. Could you relate that one?
Yeah. So this is a kind of a comical story called the No True Scotsman Fallacy. When the story goes something like this, that there's two Scotsmen sitting in a bar, and one makes a statement to the other, all true Scotsmen can hold their liquor without fail. So in walks a red bearded gentleman in a, you know, plaid kilt, clearly a Scot, and he has one drink of alcohol and falls on the ground unconscious. And so the one Scotsman looks at the other and says, well, obviously you're wrong. There's a Scotsman who couldn't hold his liquor. And his friend looks at him and says, no, I was not wrong, for clearly he is no true Scotsman. And so, this fits the form of a fraction because you're basically making a statement that you're claiming is true, which means 100% of the cases will support it. And if you ever come across a case that doesn't support it, you just invalidate that as a case. Now, it's a cute story, but it manifests itself in our politics and advertising and in all kinds of areas rather seriously. So, obviously now we all have heard this rhetoric that started in 2016 from then candidate Donald Trump. And I'm not picking on Donald Trump. He's one example, many people do this, where he said, I will accept the outcome of this great and historic election if I win. And the statement there is that any election that I don't win can therefore not be valid. Any Scotsman that falls over drunk is clearly not a Scotsman. And that's just one example, right? So the Obama administration did something similar at the end of the administration, as they were dialing down the army in Afghanistan, and they were looking at enemy-initiated attacks as a metric of how, you know, well the war was going or how badly it was going. And they were reporting that enemy-initiated attacks were dropping, therefore were winning. But during that period of time, the American army was standing down. The Afghan army was increasing their presence in the field. The number of deaths were the same, but they were only counting deaths of American soldiers in the statistics. So they were just tossing deaths out of the fraction, saying, look how much better things are getting. So you can argue whether this is intentional or not, but it's a common manifestation of misleading ideas.
Yes. And that's what's interesting about the premise of your book, is looking at what's going on in the numerator, you know, the top of the fraction versus the bottom. A lot of times, you know, we all, politicians, even scientists, tend to manipulate those things to get the outcomes, you know, that we want.
We do. Sometimes before we lie to other people, we lie to ourselves, right? Sometimes we don't know that we're doing it, but it's common. And you know, ignoring the denominator or sometimes expanding the numerator, and it leads us to just mistaken beliefs about anything that is related to, you know, probabilities, rates, odds, et cetera. I mean, we don't do it all the time. And, you know, humans are pretty smart. We get a lot of things right, but under certain circumstances, we get things tragically wrong. And this is one mechanism by which we do that.
Yeah. And that reminds me of and something, because you are immunology is your background. And I know you've been deeply involved in following what's gone on with the pandemic and our response to it. I was listening to a story on NPR News last night of people that were just not going to take the vaccines for COVID and the reasoning behind it. And that one of the things that struck me as really interesting, because, you know, there was just no way they were going to take the vaccine, and they had their reasons. One of the reasons was, and I've heard this over and over and over again, that there was a rush to get these vaccines done, that somehow, like the polio vaccine and the measles vaccines, those, you know, took place incrementally over time. And, you know, I can accept that. But this was rushed in so fast that, you know, we didn't even know this thing existed. Now suddenly we have a vaccine. How can that be safe? But that really ignores a big part of your fraction, because it's not like the idea and the technology behind mRNA vaccines was a brand new thing.
No, it was not. To be fair to that point of view, it had not been used widely in humans. And I suppose early on in the vaccine rollout, you could have said, well, the safety trials were only on 10,000 people. I'm worried that there is a complication that's less frequent than that. But now we have very good data on hundreds of millions of people, and we know what its safety profile is and what its efficacy profile is. So sadly now, focusing just on the states, because that's where I have the numbers at hand, 1 million Americans roughly have now died from COVID. Are there complications with some of the vaccines? Yes. So there have been some complications with some of the vaccines around blood clots and some heart issues, but you're basically saying, well, I'm worried about a 1 in 1 million toxicity, and therefore I'm not going to take a vaccine from a disease that has a 1 in 350 chance of killing me. And this again is what kind of falls into what is, you know, can be called the availability heuristic, that we replace how easily something comes to our mind, how prevalent it is in our thinking, and we substitute that for the actual likelihood of things happening. And in my view, it's a tragic case. Now, if you are of the disposition that I am being lied to, right? If you actually believe that the government or other people are lying to you about the data, that belief may or may not be justifiable, but then it's not a probability or rationality. You're saying it's not that I misunderstand the data or I'm discounting the data, I deny the data. And that's actually no less of a problem in our society today, of course, but a different issue.
Well, and a similar issue, and one that you've experienced with your family, and you point out in your book, and I think a lot of us have this, the fear of flying, that, you know, flying in an airplane for a lot of people, like, for example, Coach John Madden would not fly. He, you know, he got the Madden Cruiser bus because he was just scared of flying. And yet, you know, the true story is that flying is far safer than driving an automobile.
Completely. And people who drive because they're afraid of flying increase the risk of dying in an effort to be safe. But, you know, when a plane goes down, which is infrequent, but when it does, it's all over the news. They interview the family members of the victims. There's all this, commotion. The FAA investigates. There's reports coming afterwards. They try to figure out what went wrong. Sometimes it's corporate malfeasance, you know, and all kinds of real problems. And it happens so rarely, but, you know, tens of thousands of Americans die in car crashes every year. And unless a celebrity dies or it's a, you know, really dramatic pileup, we never hear about it. Hollywood makes movies about, you know, the plane disasters and planes going down and, you know, all these horror films about planes, but you don't ever see, you know, a movie called Car Crash or Fender Bender, you know, or whatever. It's just not in our minds. And so we quite predictably focus on what enters our cognition, and instead of actually looking at the broader statistical data. And that's a perfect example of what's available to you is what you think is likely.
Yeah, and you could say the same thing about swimming in the ocean. Like I know once that as a teenager, I almost drowned getting into some surf and a riptide that was really over my head, literally and figuratively. And yet, you know, people are far more afraid of sharks and things like that that are highly unlikely. And yet, you know, the ocean can drown you. That's what your fear should be. And your focus should be on how do I stay safe in the water?
I mean, more people die each year from a lethal strike of a champagne cork to the head than from shark attacks. But it's the shark attacks that are dramatic and they catch our eye because, as you pointed out, that, you know, there's Jaws 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The news does that. But yeah, so many people drowned, choked to death, all these things. And we focus on the very unlikely because it's dramatic.
So we need to come up with the champagne cork series of movies.
I think so. Yeah. Yes. Or helmet, the helmet solution. Yeah.
Oh, my. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we'll continue our conversation with James Zimring, professor of pathology at the University of Virginia. Zimring loves teaching his students about how to use scientific thinking while recognizing our human biases. His new book, Partial Truths, examines how we look at the world through the lens of fractions, percentages, and statistics. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with University of Virginia pathology professor James Zimring about his new book, Partial Truths. Okay, let's talk about how our brains work. And you mentioned a term there, a heuristic. It's a fairly common term, but for all of us, could you explain what heuristics, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, in basic terms, a heuristic is a rule of thumb thinking, sort of a reflex way we think about stuff, which works very quickly and usually gets things right, but it is a shortcut. Sometimes we take an actual problem and reduce it to a simpler problem without knowing we've done so, and therefore we can get things wrong. And without heuristics, we would be mentally paralyzed, right? So much information is coming at us so quickly all the time that if we sat down and logically, formally analyze everything, we'd just be a quivering ball of gray matter. We wouldn't, you know, be able to handle the world. But what happens is we pass over things, we make errors, we don't notice we've made the errors, and then it gets incorporated into our thinking. And the availability heuristic is just one of many which have been, you know, defined by cognitive psychologists. The Nobel Prizes have been given for this, and also behavioral economics as well.
When you give some really cool examples of this, and I have experienced this before, and I do the same thing. One of my favorites is the ball and the bat problem, where you've got the ball and the bat, and together, I think I got this right, they cost $1.10. And if you take you say the bat is a dollar more than the ball, and then you ask, how much is the ball? And everybody, like me included, the first thought that pops into your head is 10 cents. I mean, that is just normal human thinking. And yet, explain to us.
Well, so as you pointed out, if you're setting conditions that have to be fulfilled for your answer to be correct, and the first condition is a bat and a ball cost a total of $1.10, okay? And the bat cost $1 more than the ball. Okay, so you say the ball costs 10 cents, but you violated that the bat costs a dollar more than the ball, because if the bat cost a dollar and the ball costs 10 cents, the bat only costs 90 cents more than the ball. So once you realize that contradiction with some reflective thinking, people come to the answer that, oh, if you make the bat cost $1.05 and the ball 5 cents, now I've solved the problem. But that's not what comes to mind first, as you pointed out, for most of us, certainly me, and we don't notice it. You know, we don't notice the contradictions, and then we go on our way.
Yeah, and there's another great example you give. It's the five widgets and five machines. Five machines making five widgets, and it takes them 5 minutes. Could you give us that example too? Because that's a really cool one.
Yeah, so this is a classic example. You're asked, if it takes 5 minutes for five machines to make five widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets?
And 100 minutes, obviously.
Yeah, right. Yes, but no.
No.
Why not? Well,
Jim.
Yeah, I know. It's regrettable, right?
Oh, but gosh. So
if it takes 5 minutes for five machines to make five widgets, then each machine makes one widget every 5 minutes. So 100 machines can make 100 widgets in 5 minutes.
Yes. It's fascinating how our minds jump to that answer. It's just, it's amazing. Okay, I want to bring in our producer, Matt Fidler, and try and experiment on him with one of these kinds of problems. Matt, are you ready?
Oh, man, I'm scared about this already.
Okay, well, this one's kind of simple. Okay, so.
I got the ball and baseball bat one, though.
Oh, good.
I was proud of myself.
Yeah, way to go, Matt. You might, and maybe you already know this one, but I'm going to give you three numbers. And I'm going to tell you there's a rule to arriving at these three numbers. And what I want you to do is I want you to give me a sequence of three numbers that you can choose that you think also conforms to the same rule. Okay?
Okay. So wait, you're going to give me the rule or just the three numbers?
No, I'm not going to give you the rule. I'm going to give you three numbers. I want you to give me three numbers that you think conform to the rule and then see if you can figure out the rule. Okay. So you ready?
Okay.
All right. So the numbers are 2, 4, 8. So you give me three numbers that you think conform to that same rule.
Okay. How about 3, 6, 12?
That does conform to the rule. Okay. Give me three more.
All right. 10, 20, 40.
Okay. Yes, that conforms to the rule as well. How about one more? One more set.
Okay. 4, 8, 16.
Oh, okay. Very good. Also, matches the rule. Can you guess what the rule is?
Each number is double of the last.
No, that's not the rule.
You want to try? Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Really?
Yeah, really. You want to try one more? I'll give you one more.
Okay.
One more set.
0, 0, 0.
Ooh, that does not conform to the rule.
It doesn't?
No.
Okay, what...
Interesting, though. Interesting.
I was trying to do something a little different.
Very
still
good.
Conform to my rule.
Okay, Jim, you want to take over from here? What's happening? What's happening here with Matt?
Hi, Matt. So,
hey, Jim.
What has just been demonstrated here is a cognitive exercise that was developed by Peter Wason, who was this great cognitive psychologist who was very talented at finding things that human minds tend to do. And so when people are given a series of numbers, they tend to come up with a rule that would explain those numbers and then give examples that conform to the rule. And if they're said yes, then they give another example that conforms to the rule, yes again, and then they become very confident in what the rule is. But the issue is they tend to seek confirmation of the rule, not typically give examples that would reject the rule. And this, at least according to Wason's interpretation of the task, is important because it demonstrates our tendency to confirm but not reject our ideas, which goes into the notion of confirmation bias, which is one of these, if I had to pick the most embarrassing thing that humans do, all humans, including me, that would be it.
Yeah, and you did a really cool thing though there, Matt, is that you came up with something that, you know, didn't seem to conform to what you thought was going on. And, you know, really the answer is, if I was to give you, I can probably give it away right now. Here's an example. 1, 2, 3.
So just really anything has to be bigger than the last one?
Yeah, just
so
ascending.
It really didn't matter.
Just ascending order. Okay.
So I could have said 1 billion, 1 trillion.
Yeah, but if you kept doing that, you probably would not have figured out the rule.
It was a very simple rule, and so part of it I was expected to be too complicated.
But what you did was very cool. Is when you came up with a no answer. It tells you. And Jim, what do you have to say about this? The no answer tells you much more than the confirmation.
Certainly, deductively more certain information. Yeah. And actually, in the initial experiments, the people who tended to seek rejecting information instead of confirming information got to the answer quicker and more accurately. The other thing that Matt did was he chose a more specific rule in favor of a more general rule that would have still captured all of the examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's talk a bit about confirmation bias, because it really is a huge issue in our society today, and you devote quite a bit of time to it. Give us some examples of that, you know, that you'd like to share with us.
Well, so confirmation bias is taking all of the evidence and filtering it. So you tend to focus on the things that support that which you already believe, and you tend to not notice or dismiss things that go against what you already believe. And this attaches to any belief, whether it's helps you, hurts you, is indifferent. And it's kind of a bizarre thing that humans do. Whatever we believe first, then we start to filter experience accordingly. So in some ways, it's not that seeing is believing, it's that believing is seeing. Yeah. And so I refer back to a study that was done some decades ago, but could not be more apropos to our current situation, is that they took two groups of students who had been pre-screened for opposite political views. In this case, it was whether the death penalty is a deterrent or not. And they were each given some scientific studies to read on this question. And both sides, having read the identical data, became more strongly convinced of what they already believed with the same data.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, we look at our world today and we see groups of people who just can't understand how the other group could possibly believe what they do. They must be either irrational idiots or disingenuously lying. But if you experience the world differently based upon what you already believe, that explains an awful lot of our disagreement.
Well, and a really good example of that is if like a lot of my elderly relatives, I know some that, you know, they have Fox News on literally like 24 hours a day. It's like they even go to sleep to it. And if that's all that you're getting, then there you go. And the same thing could be said for somebody that only watches MSNBC, you know, on the other side. We tend to just want to live in our bubbles.
We do. And it's not just what we seek out and we enjoy, but it resonates with us. There's this thing that's part of confirmation bias called the primacy effect, where if you show people a picture that's so out of focus, you can't tell what it is. And then you show them a series of pictures coming more and more into focus. When they get to a picture that's focused enough that other people can clearly tell what it is, they will stick with their original guess, even though it's obviously incorrect. Now, not forever, right? I mean, if you guessed a car and it's a cat, eventually you'll say, yeah, it's a cat, but certainly much longer than you would predict. And so it is this way that we have a very hard time changing our beliefs, even in the presence of disconfirming evidence.
Yes, and even like the most intelligent people, like for example, I heard a story on NPR again last night. I'm plugging NPR shamelessly here. It was about the Supreme Court decision in the Cruz versus the Federal Elections Commission. And you had Justice Kagan weighing in on one opinion and Chief Justice Roberts in another. And yet they were citing the same study and coming up with these dramatically different conclusions. And these are two highly intelligent people.
Yeah. And so I think that one of the kind of less appreciated toxicities of confirmation bias is it's not just that we don't recognize it in ourselves. Because we don't recognize it in other people, we assume they must be maliciously lying or twisting information for some agenda of theirs. We discount the possibility that they may be looking at the same world we are and seeing something different.
Yeah. Okay, let's, while we're kind of on the subject of politics, you have a really interesting chapter about the Iraq War. And I remember the search for, you know, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. the justification that Iraq was tied to the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Tell us a bit about what some of the things you discovered that you share in there.
Yeah, well, I think that we have a little bit of hindsight here, which could lead to hindsight bias, as we now know that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But at the time, President Bush, did not, you know, decide unilaterally to go to war. He decided to make a case to the people, to the Congress, and to the United Nations, arguing that there must be weapons of mass destruction. And because he chose to make a case, he was presenting evidence, he and the members of his administration. And there were massive amounts of evidence to suggest, one, that Iraq had no connection with Al-Qaeda and it was unrelated to the 9/11 attack, which was one of the rationales. And the other was very dubious evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction. And what they did is they chose, you know, very, very unlikely evidence and kind of twisted it to support it and ignored all the other evidence and pressured the intelligence agencies to do the same because they had a conclusion that they wanted and they would only allow rhetoric that supported it. And ultimately, we went to war and we all know what happened. Now, I think that it's fair to say that Saddam Hussein acted in a way that would make people suspicious. It was not as though, you know, there was no history of weapons of mass destruction or of him hiding them. And so it was quite reasonable to be concerned. But they had United Nations inspectors in there. They couldn't find anything. And so they came up with these stories based upon testimony of witnesses that were tortured by foreign intelligence agencies. And it was on these scant little bits of evidence that they launched a war that killed a great number of people. I'm not saying, by the way, that Saddam Hussein was a nice guy. I'm not saying that it may or may not have been ultimately a reasonable decision, but the evidence upon which the decision was made was clearly twisted, probably cherry-picked intentionally by some, and honest confirmation bias by others, which a number of the players involved in retrospect acknowledged that they just didn't really, you know, dive deep into it as much as they should. But, you know, what is more consequential than the decision to go to war? And this is nothing new. If there's a, you know, this has been with humans as long as we have written records. Thucydides, you know, over 300 BC, complained about this phenomenon during the Peloponnesian War. So this is a lesson apparently we haven't learned because we fall into this trap over and over again.
We are condemned to repeat it.
Well, I hope not, but we certainly should pay attention to it.
It sure seems that way. Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Jim Zimring, the author of the new book, Partial Truths, which examines how we view, perceive, and often are misled in areas from the criminal justice system to scientific discovery in a modern world dominated by data and statistics. And he uses the lens of fractions as our guide. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with James Zimring. Jim is the Thomas Tallack Professor of Experimental Pathology at the University of Virginia and the author of a follow-up book to his What Science Is and How It Really Works. The new book, Partial Truths, is an accessible but extensive look at how human beings try to find the truth in a world that can often feel confusing due to claims based on data and statistics, which are often manipulated or just misunderstood. I'd like you to talk a bit about the scientific method and how it uses the idea of statistics, fractions, and statistical analysis and looking for bias and error. Could you talk a bit about what the scientific method is like now compared to like back when like the original elements were being discovered by guys like Joseph Priestley, or back in the day with Michael Faraday discovering, you know, magnetic fields were related to electric fields. That, could you talk a bit about the scientific method now and its use of these tools?
Yeah, thank you. You know, one of the criticisms that's made about attempts to define scientific method is that if there are principles of the scientific method, how come it changes over time? And one can look at it and say, well, one of the core tenets of scientific methods is that when we find sources of error, we generate methods to mitigate or hopefully eliminate that error. And over time, we're learning more and more sources of error. So let me use an example, for instance, on the MMR vaccine, right? So there have been a lot of concerns by people that the measles vaccine causes autism. And by the way, these are very legitimate concerns because autism manifests at 2 years of age, usually. So you have a healthy kid until 2 years of age, they start to show symptoms. And the measles vaccine is usually given at 15 to 18 months of age. So inevitably, children who develop autism, their parents had a healthy child, and then they got the measles vaccine, and then they got autism. So those parents, and I give them a lot of credit, experience their kid getting autism after getting the measles vaccine. And that would be this before that conclusion. Now, the problem with that type of reasoning is that by that argument, gray hair causes heart disease, and that we should have a massive public health campaign for all of us to, you know, dye our hair black. So what a science then does and says, well, wait a minute, let's take a look at this. What evidence would support or refute that concept? Let's investigate it, because we should. And you would say, well, if the MMR caused autism, then kids getting the measles vaccine should have a higher rate of autism than kids not. Or kids getting the vaccine with thimerosal should have a higher rate of autism than not. Or countries that have implemented the vaccine, the rate of autism should be higher after than before. Those studies have been done, and they have shown absolutely no effect. And those are the data that support this idea that the vaccine is safe, that it's anecdotal evidence versus statistical evidence. But science doesn't stop there, because anytime you look at two groups, those that got the vaccine, those that didn't, or, you know, let's say that you think that crystal therapy causes health, and you say, all right, I'm going to take people with a disease, half of them I'm going to give crystal therapy, half of them not, who did better? There is a probability that people who were going to do better anyway wind up in one group and not the other, just by chance alone. So if you're running a drug trial, and the people who got the drug do better than the people who didn't get the drug may work, or it was just a chance effect of the people who were going to do better anyway getting the drug. And so modern statistics has specific methods of quantifying the likelihood of errors like that happening. It can't eliminate the errors, but it can tell you how likely are the errors to occur. These are called, you know, p-values. The formal definition is a little bit more complex, but that's more or less it. If you assume there's nothing there, what are the odds of mistakenly seeing an effect? And the scientific community has agreed upon a certain level of allowable error. And if the statistics don't rise to that occasion, then we say the drug doesn't have an effect. And right now, in general, although there is some debate about this, the allowable error is 5% of the time. You say, well, why 5%? Why not 1%? Why not 0.1%? I would like less error. Wouldn't you like less error? And the answer is that doing research takes resources and has ethical considerations, and there's only, you know, so much uncertainty you can get rid of.
Yeah. And one of the things that I find fascinating about science as it's being practiced now is we're seeing much more diversity in the sciences, where when you talk about studying like planets, like the Earth, things used to be so separate. You know, you had a geologist and a chemist over here, and, you know, never the twain should meet. And now we're seeing more of a movement where the sciences are much more integrated. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you have to say about that and the way that science has developed in the last, you know, 50 years?
Well, you know, humans have a categorization error and problem. And what I mean by that is that we have to break down the world into categories and bite-sized pieces in order to understand it. If you tried to drink the world whole, you really couldn't get anywhere. So we break biological disciplines into, you know, immunology or cardiology or neurobiology. And sometimes it's really funny. You'll hear people saying, oh, well, you know, she's a neurobiologist. Oh, well, he's an immunologist. Well, they don't, you know, can't necessarily communicate with each other. At the end of the day, we're all studying the same thing, but we're looking at it from different angles. And the effort to have interdisciplinary collaboration, which is a large push right now, across fields that even, you know, are seemingly unrelated. So geology and evolutionary biology historically have been connected at the hip, even though they're studying completely different things, because the age of the Earth is a fundamental question on whether evolution theory could possibly be correct. So, I mean, if the Earth had turned out to be very young, evolution theory could not be correct. It couldn't have worked. And so these kind of cross-germinations will always be important. And also they bring a diversity of view to questions that allows a reasoned debate to take place, because yes, we have confirmation bias. We may all see the world differently, but we can be convinced based on reasoning that another person is correct. And so the diversity is essential to the dialogue.
Well, that reminds me of another one of your chapters. I believe it's called The Appearance of Design in the Natural World. Could you talk a bit about that section of your book?
Yeah, so there's two separate issues at play here. But first of all, the design issue. So I don't think anyone, well, most people would agree that the world, the universe and life has the appearance of being designed. Everything fits together seamlessly and in beautiful, you know, interdigitation. It's incredible. You know, the flower needs the bee in order, you know, for to spread its pollen around. The bee needs the pollen in order to make honey. And, you know, and it goes throughout biology, and it also is inside of us, the molecular biology, the cellular biology, how everything lines up. It's intricate. It is so beautiful and amazing that people argue there's no way this came about by accident. Therefore, it must have been designed. Now, with regards to life, that's kind of a problematic interpretation, because evolution theory, as a function of how it works, indicates that life adapts to its environment slowly over time. We see it, you know, in a snapshot. Humans have been writing things down for 2,400 years, which is the, you know, most infinitesimal slice of evolution time. If the world suddenly fluxed into being today, or over the last 6,000 years, yeah, there's no time for evolution to work. But evolution is a self-adjusting fraction. By evolution theory, life has to be fine-tuned to itself. It is inevitably fine-tuned to itself. The analogy I use is that it's like looking at a pool of water and being amazed at how well the water fits the shape of the pool. There's no way that could happen by chance alone. It must have been designed. But, you know, and I'm not, by the way, I am not here to argue against intelligent design theory. I am here to analyze the probability argument for it, because that's really what the book is about.
Right.
But what is ironic here is that evolution is a better explanation of the fine-tuned nature of life than intelligent design. It's not just that it's not a problem, it is a better explanation. Why is that? Because according to evolution theory, life must be fine-tuned. If life was not fine-tuned, that would really be a problem for evolution theory. We'd have to toss out or modify the theory severely. But intelligent design, well, the designer can do anything the designer wants. Make life fine-tuned, make life not fine-tuned, have no life at all, you know, whatever. So this idea that because life is fine-tuned to itself, and that's incredibly unlikely, there must have been a designer, just doesn't hold when you understand. And the analogy of the fraction applied here, because it's basically a self-adjusting fraction. The argument gets more complex when you talk about the physical constants of the world. And I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but there's
sure.
Also, well, okay. So if you look at the physical constants of the universe,
like, for example, like the gravitational constant, like 6.67 times 10 to the negative 11th, all those wonderful numbers that are the recipes for how physics and nature works. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, the universe is such that even the smallest perturbation, mm-hmm. anywhere, and the whole thing would be unstable and we wouldn't be here now. And people say, wow, that's incredibly unlikely, almost impossible. That is impossible. That could not have fluxed into being on its own. There must have been a designer. Now, again, I'm not arguing against the designer, but I'm addressing the probability argument for a designer. And the problem with that approach is severalfold. First of all, there's what's called the anthropic principle, which some mm-hmm. people find compelling, others not. But basically, the anthropic principle ties into what's called survivorship bias. The only universes in which there would be creatures wondering where the universe came from are universes that could support life. right? If you interviewed Dave, 20 people who played Russian roulette, all of them would say they're very lucky people.
Right. But I'm not going to be interviewing the losers.
No, that's right. And so the survivorship bias is important there. But those people who argue with that say, wait a minute, you're asking the wrong question. It's not that we are here observing the universe you should be questioning. It's that the universe is here at all. And then you have to say, well, you know, it is incredibly unlikely that our universe would be the way it is. Yes. But any universe would be equally unlikely. It's kind of like saying, you know, I have certain physical characteristics. It's incredibly unlikely that my parents would come together and have someone with my physical characteristics of the 70 trillion different humans that my parents could have given rise to. And so, I explain, why am I here? Well, because my parents had me. But why do I happen to have the physical characteristics that I do? Well, that's not a question we ask. It was just a chance effect. But as unlikely as it is that I have all of my physical characteristics, it's less likely that I would have none in case I was alive. So our universe is just, you know, it's going to be unlikely, whatever it is, if it's one universe. And the argument to that is, well, yes, but humans have the ability to recognize created things. And an analogy I like is looking at a carving in a mountain, and then there's rubble at the base of the mountain from having blasted the carving. You look at the carving and say, that configuration shows me that it was designed, because that's what things that humans design look like. Now, all the rubble on the ground is equally unlikely, but that's what things that are not designed look like. And when I look at the world, that's what design things look like. And the only reasonable comment on that, in my view, is that how much experience do we have comparing universes that were designed to universes that came into being by chance or evolved, you know, developed by some natural property? And the answer is none, zero. Yeah. So saying that, well, I have experience with what, you know, design things look like on Earth, it kind of doesn't apply. So this argument that everything is so unlikely that the only possible explanation is a designer really, you know, betrays an understanding of probability in these ways.
One of the things I love about your book is the title itself, Partial Truths, with, you know, the fraction bar between partial on the top. Partial is the numerator and truths is the denominator. And, you know, basically what a fraction is it's, you know, kind of a part divided by a whole, unless, you know, you've got a fraction where it's greater than that. But we generally think in terms of, you know, one half or one third and things like that. It's impossible for us as human beings to know the whole truth of everything. And, you know, like I think of in physics, the quest for the theory of everything, to try to unify quantum mechanics theory with gravitational theory, general relativity, and Einstein, that it really is impossible for us to know everything. We can only know partial truth. And yet that is one of the wonders of being a human being, is to know, you know, incrementally little bits more and more about, you know, how our universe works and how nature works.
For me personally, being a professional scientist, it's the most exciting part of what I do, is that you can figure out some small corner of nature, or at least come up with an explanation that gives you the ability to predict and control, you know, what you're studying. And a little light bulb goes off. Actually, humans love to solve patterns. When something's bothering you, you have cognitive dissonance until you come up with some way to resolve the contradictions. And if you put people in a scanner, when they, an fMRI to look at their brain, what happens when you solve a problem, which is basically finding a partial truth, is that you get the same kind of neurotransmitter release as if you're eating chocolate or engaging in other very pleasurable activities or actually taking cocaine. And so we have evolved, or you could say we are kind of suited to or programmed to go after figuring out partial truths because it feels good, presumably because it gives us an evolutionary advantage, but I'm not worried about that. I do it because it feels good and it's useful, right? You can help with human suffering and other things. And so yeah, but the sad part of being human is, as you pointed out, we are not, I don't think we're at risk of solving the universe anytime soon. I could be wrong. I'm pretty confident in that statement.
I think that's probably a good thing. I don't know that we would want to be that. And your statement really reminds me of something I've heard again and again and again on this program from great scientists, that you know, the moments of the greatest joy are like walking into the control room, perhaps at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at, late at night, and you look up and you see something nobody has ever seen before on Mars. And you know, I'm the first person seeing this. And that is just, those moments of discovery are just so, they're wonderful. And like you said, they provide that same kind of release of pleasure.
Absolutely, you're right. And I would posit the second most profound moment of joy, and this is counterintuitive to some people who are not in the sciences, the second most amazing moment of joy is when you get a piece of data that unequivocally shows
you're
wrong.
Yes. Yes,
that and is that's the best thing ever.
Well, Jim, it was a joy to talk to you as always, and really enjoyed the book, Partial Truths.
Well, thanks. And thanks so much for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, University of Virginia pathology professor James Imrie. His new book, Partial Truths, is out from Columbia University Press and available at most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at blue.nspr. Our social media coordinator is Angela Osterello. The theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.